Revisit this with us today, and we give you all a very warm pleasure in calling them now.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, we assemble this day to draw nigh to the throne of grace and to reflect very carefully upon the work of the Son of God. It is indeed a great work that has been achieved on our part. That we have been, by the blood of Christ, drawn to the very presence of the Father by the work of the Son. And yet with that great privilege, as we remember this day, there does come a responsibility. In the Epistle of Jude, which was read this afternoon, Jude found it necessary to write to the brethren and sisters and to exhort them that they should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. And sometimes that earnest contention can become very wearing at times, but is necessary to maintain the greatness and the virility of the truth that we love, to contend earnestly for the things that we hold so dear, is a necessary part of our responsibility in the truth. To warn them, he said in verse 5, I will therefore put you in remembrance, though you once knew this, how that the Lord, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed them that believed not. How tragic that was. To save people and then afterwards destroy them because of their unbelief. When we come across to Hebrews chapter 3, we find in fact that Paul tells us specifically what the problem was. All these things happen unto them for ensamples. They are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age are come. Now, in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 10, God says this, Wherefore I was grieved with that generation and said, They do always err in their heart. They have not known my ways. See, Moses was different. He was shown the ways of God, but this people didn't know God's ways. So I swear in my wrath that they should not enter into my rest. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. And that, tragically, is our biggest struggle. In fact, sometimes we can contend earnestly for the faith and yet be deceived by sin in our own lives. And there can develop within us an evil heart of unbelief. Yes, we attend meetings and we attend the functions of the ecclesia and we go to fraternals and all of those things, but they're done sometimes very mechanically. The heart must be affected. In this generation, there was a people who didn't know God's ways, the way he worked, the way he operated, his character and purpose. And the heart was unaffected. You see, sin is an enemy that can deceive us. We can think we are doing the things of the truth. Yet in reality, our heart really hasn't been changed by the effectiveness of the word. This generation erred in their heart. The antidote to that is explained to us in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 11. Let us labor, he says, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. Now, that's a remarkable statement. The heart of the generation in the wilderness fell because their heart was unaffected by the power of the word. And one would have thought that Paul would have said, that the heart should be changed by the word of God. Well, that's true. But in chapter 4 and verse 11, he says that we should labor to enter into the rest, lest we also develop the same unbelief. When we come across the Proverbs chapter 16, this is what Paul is saying. Laboring and working and being occupied in the things of the truth is a very necessary part of our life, which can in fact change the heart. In Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 3, the Proverbs says this: commit thy works unto Yahweh, and thy thoughts shall be established. Now look at that verse. If we commit, or as the margin says, we roll our works unto God. In other words, we do things to the honor of God's name, then the thoughts are established. That's remarkable. The actions dedicating themselves to the glory of God can help fix and fasten the motives and the thoughts. The heart has a goal, and that is to work for God and to labor in His service. And that, if it's committed to God, the heart can be affected by that. And the heart of unbelief can be minimized. And that's why Paul said in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 11, let us labor to enter into rest. Working, brethren and sisters. And there is an enormous work to do. Think of all the people you come in contact with during the day. The opportunities to preach the truth. Think of the reading that needs to be done, the Bible marking, and the children to educate in the things of God. And the sick amongst us, and the needy to be helped and encouraged. The studies to pursue, the ecclesia to build. Enormous work, brethren and sisters, that needs to be done by all of us. We can become centres of influences for good within our ecclesia if we labour to enter into that rest. And by doing it to God's glory, the thoughts are established and the motives are corrected. And the evil heart of unbelief can be minimized. Now this afternoon we're going to consider a group of Israelites in the wilderness generation who defied the whole of the pattern of disbelief. And they labored to enter into their rest. I believe that Paul is in fact alluding to this group of people in the wilderness. They're found in Numbers chapter 32. Let's have a look at them. Sometimes we can become depressed when we look at the wilderness generation. God saved them to destroy them, tragically. But there was a group who in fact did labor to enter into their rest. Now they're found in Numbers chapter 32. We read in verse 1. Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of cattle. And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that behold, the place was a place of cattle. The children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spake to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the princes of the congregation, saying, Ataroth and Dibon and Jazer and Nimrah and Heshbon and Aleleh, Shebam and Nebo and Beon, even the country which Yahweh smote before the congregation of Israel, is a land for cattle, and thy servants have cattle. Now this group in the wilderness are known as the 2.5 tribes. Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh. And they were a group of people who defied the generation of unbelief. Now, did you notice as I read those four verses that there was an emphasis through those verses? The place was for much cattle. They had much cattle. Four times in four verses, the point is made, they had huge numbers of cattle. Now, why is the record saying that? What's the purpose of the emphasis there? Well, the first point is, have you ever tried raising cows in a desert? It was a miracle that the cattle had increased. You can't raise cattle in the Sinai Peninsula in desert conditions. And yet this people were blessed with enormous herds of cattle. The first point we're being told is it's a miracle that God has blessed them the way he has. In fact, when we come to Deuteronomy, just keep your hand in Numbers, come to Deuteronomy 28, we know it is in fact one of the direct blessings of God. We learn in Deuteronomy chapter 28, and verse 11, Yahweh shall make thee plenteous in goods, in the fruit of thy body, in the fruit of thy cattle, and in the fruit of the ground, in the land which Yahweh sware unto thy fathers to give thee. So there will be blessings in the land. But in verse 4, there was the blessings in this generation too. Blessed shalt thou be the fruit of thy body, the fruit of the ground, and the fruit of thy cattle, the increase of thy kine, and the flocks of thy sheep. So those who were obedient to the things of God were to be blessed in their cattle. And these people stood there in exactly that position. God had blessed them. In fact, the ox in Psalm 144 verse 14 is a symbol of labor. God had blessed their labor in Israel. And do you know why? Because they were the only tribes that had retaining their occupation that their fathers had. When the 12 descended into Egypt, they said, the trade of thy servants hath been about cattle from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers. And the rest of the tribes had changed their occupation, except these two. They remained faithful to the pursuits of their fathers, even during Egyptian bondage. Everyone else was out having to make bricks, and they too had to make bricks. But they made sure that the occupation of their fathers was maintained through their life. They refused to abandon the principles of shepherding. They were a different group of people. Now in verse 4, they recognized that Yahweh had smitten before the congregation the country that they were in. It was an amazing victory where the Jewish people moved across the eastern portion of the land, east of Jordan, and pushed out enormous, powerful armies. Rahab was deeply impressed with that. Sihon, king of Og. It was a glorious victory, their first real, tangible taste of victory over the enemy after 40 years of languishing in the desert. And there may have been some who thought the victory was their own, but not these people. Yahweh smote before us the enemy. There was a clear understanding that God had worked with them. You see, they are a different group of people, aren't they? Now in verse 5, they said, if we have found grace in thy sight, let this land be given unto thy servants for a possession, and bring us not over Jordan. Now that's an amazing statement. If we have found grace, let this land be given to us. They knew that the inheritance that they were about to receive was a free gift, only given by grace. They didn't deserve it. They didn't earn it through works of law or through their own righteousness. If we found grace, It's a gift. They had no right for their own personal righteousness for that inheritance. You know, there are different people, aren't they? That's a difficult balance to achieve. I'd like you to come across to Ephesians chapter 2. See, this matter of the inheritance being a gift, we don't really, in that sense, deserve it because we're not righteous. We have no righteousness of our own. And yet at the same time, we must work the works of God. Paul said, labor to enter into rest. And yet the inheritance is by grace. Now look at the balance that Paul achieves in Ephesians chapter 2. And it really is the balance that these tribes understood. Yahweh was working with them, and yet they too recognized that it was a gift. In Ephesians 2 and verse 8, Paul says this: "For by grace are you saved through faith, not of yourselves, it is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast." Now, if we read those two verses in isolation, we could simply understand that we've been called into the truth. And as long as we believe the things of the truth, we don't have to do anything, not of works, lest any man should boast. God will give us the kingdom. It's a free gift. The Protestant churches believe that. Salvation by faith alone. Don't do anything. But Paul redresses the balance in the next verse. And it's a wonderful way of expressing it. For he says in verse 10, we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them. Now look at that expression. We realize we have no righteousness of our own. We can't work our way into the kingdom. We believe the things that God has given us, and God justifies us because of our faith. We are counted righteous because of our faith. We realize that when God gives us eternal life, God willing, it is by His mercy. It's a gift, a free gift, undeserved. And yet in verse 10, we have to do something about it. But the works are styled in verse 10, good works. They are works that spring from faith. And the motivation of doing the works is God. It's His workmanship. He works in us. He supplies the will, the motivation, and the strength to do it. Now it's that very careful balance that we need to get in ecclesial life. We labour to enter into rest. But it's not our own strength and our own self-righteousness. It is in recognition that we are unworthy of the things that God is going to give us in that kingdom. Now, when we come back to Numbers 32, that's exactly the thought of these people. Exactly these people. God was working in them. They smote the enemy, but it was God who smote the enemy before them. And the inheritance was a free gift. And that balance, which Paul explained, is really found in those two verses in Numbers chapter 32. Now, Moses' reaction was heated. In fact, from verse 6 to verse 15, we have a very strong rebuke from Moses. I mean, he stood there listening to this request. There was Reuben and Gad. And he knew the prophecies concerning Reuben and Gad. Reuben, said Jacob in Genesis 49, was unstable as water. Thou shalt not excel. Here was a very unstable tribe. Thou shalt not excel. And hadn't that tribe spawned Dathan and Abiram and caused untold misery in the camp? Moses was skeptical of these people initially. And Gad. He knew the prophecy concerning Gad. A troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. He will be defeated. He will be overcome. and knowing the overall heart of unbelief in that nation, Moses made a very strong rebuke. He accused them of attempting to discourage the nation. Now you imagine, if you made a request to Moses to take part of the land and you were rebuked by Moses himself. It's a very strong rebuke from verse 16 through to verse 15. Verse after verse after verse, rebuking these people. I wonder what you'd do. I wonder how we would have responded to the rebuke that Moses, the man of God himself, gave to these people. Do you know how these people responded? In verse 16, they came near unto him. That's an amazing reaction. They didn't walk off in a huff. They didn't disappear muttering obscenities under their breath. They didn't challenge Moses to say, well, who do you think you are to tell us what to do? None of that at all, brothers and sisters. They came near to him. They sought to resolve the dispute and to correct the misunderstanding. That's remarkable. Because sometimes we are rebuked. And sometimes we may feel that we are rebuked unnecessarily. You don't strike back. You draw near to resolve the dispute and to correct the misunderstanding, like these men. That's a tremendous reaction, brothers and sisters. I mean, they could have just thrown their hands up in the air and just stormed off, but that wasn't the way these people worked. They're a different group of people. 38 years in the desert had changed them for the better. Proverbs 9 verse 8 says, rebuke a wise man and he shall love thee. Rebuke a wise man and he shall love thee. I wonder whether we can really fall into that category. To understand the spirit behind the rebuke and to take the advice and to respond and to say, thank you. That's foreign to human nature. He will love thee because you've corrected him in the right way. These were these kind of people. They drew near unto him. An amazing response. Now, what did they say? What was their reaction? Well, the verse in verse 16 goes on to describe their attitude towards their inheritance. Now, what was their attitude? Take it easy? Sit back and do nothing? Well, look at verse 16. We will build sheepfolds here for our cattle and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves will go ready armed before the children of Israel until we've brought them unto their place. And our little ones shall dwell in the fenced cities because of the inhabitants of the land. That is an amazing reaction. We will build sheepfolds. And the Hebrew word really is two words. It's fortified walls for the sheep. That's the literal Hebrew expression. Fortified walls for the sheep. And for our cattle and cities for our little ones. Now their concern was for the sheep and the little ones. I'd like it to come across to Matthew 18. See, there is a deeper meaning in this chapter. The language used is carefully recorded. The sheep and the little ones. That's whom they were concerned with. Moses said, look, you're discouraging the people. If you take this part of the land, the others won't get their inheritance either. And you'll just endure your inheritance and your brethren will go unfulfilled. And they said, no. We will build fortified walls for our sheep and for our little ones and we'll help our brethren. The sheep and the little ones. Well, in Matthew chapter 18, the Lord said in verse 10, take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones, For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. For the Son of Man is come to save that which is lost. How think ye, if a man have 100 sheep, and one of them be gone astray, doth he not leave the 99 and goeth into the mountains, and seeketh that which is gone astray? And if so be that he find it, verily I say to you, he rejoices more of that sheep than of the 99 which went astray. Even so it is not the will of your Father which is in heaven, that one of these little ones should perish. Here is the care for the sheep and the little ones. There was a concern in that group as they labored to enter into their rest, not to forget the sheep of their ecclesia. Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones, he said. They could have easily just put the sheep somewhere else or given them away or whatever, but no, they wanted to protect them, fortified walls. And for the little ones. That's the disposition they had. In Psalm 89, we really have an idea of the importance of this protection. The word folds there occurs in the 89th Psalm. The protection in the ecclesia. Now in Psalm 89 and verse 38, the psalmist laments the seeming destruction of the Davidic covenant. In verse 38, thou hast cast off and abhorred, thou hast been wroth with thine anointed, thou hast made void the covenant of thy servant. Thou hast profaned his crown by casting it to the ground. And here's a situation where the psalmist sees the whole Davidic promise is coming unraveled. The nation cast off and abhorred, the throne being trodden into the dust, the crown lying unworn. And then in verse 40, of equal tragedy, thou hast broken down all his hedges. Thou hast brought his strongholds to ruin. Now the word hedges there is the word folds in Numbers chapter 32 verse 16. To lose one's king was of equal devastation as losing the protection and the walls around the little ones. What's the record telling us? Well, you see, brothers and sisters, we do have walls around the truth. Things like the statement of faith, the ecclesial guide, our ecclesial standards are all the walls that protect us all. Because they foster in us the truth and a disposition that is correct towards the truth. And when those protections are removed, then disaster falls upon the ecclesia. And these people who wanted to labor to enter their rest understood fully the importance of maintaining those standards. They are not easy to maintain against an age that pressures and pushes against them to destroy them. But our personal integrity in the things of right and wrong is at stake. As we mentioned last night, we saw a king who loved righteousness and hated wickedness. And those walls, brethren and sisters, are so necessary in our personal lives for the little ones and the sheep. For the Son of Man is come to save that which is lost, to redeem and to draw and to edify. When we come back to Numbers 32, that's exactly what these people were doing. Exactly. The record's not just telling us they were interested in locking up the sheep at night. There's a deeper significance behind that. And look at their response to other people in verse 17. We ourselves will go ready armed, There was a personal commitment and involvement. We ourselves, when they were asked to do a job, they did it. When they were asked to do a service to the ecclesia, they did it. We ourselves didn't rely on the person sitting next to them. And look what they did. We will go ready armed until we have brought them unto their place. What an attitude. They were prepared to support their brethren until their brethren received their inheritance. What a magnificent attitude. They left their children guarded and protected. And 40,000, which wasn't all the tribes, but 40,000, a goodly number, came across and were prepared to help their brethren until they reached the kingdom. That's an amazing and wonderful response. That's laboring to enter into their rest. A wonderful example to us all. An enormous sacrifice to leave their families for some time, to labor on behalf of others, to bear their own burdens and the burdens of others. That is wonderful, brothers, until their brethren received their inheritance. They didn't say 3 weeks or 4 weeks or a year, but until we've got them there. That's a tremendous attitude. And you know, Moses was impressed with that. Moses was impressed by their attitude and he agreed to their terms. You see, he's not an inflexible man. He realized his mistake. And he said, yes, you can do that. And in fact, he made those 2.5 tribes to make an oath before him. Soon after this, Moses died and Joshua took over. And this really is when the test comes. See, in the full flush of zeal and enthusiasm, we sometimes are very keen to make all sorts of promises. Yes, I'll do that. Yes, no problems. But when the time comes, we're sometimes not as willing to fulfill those promises, are we? You imagine the temptation to stay behind with your family. Moses is dead. He's not going to know if we've broken our promise. What would be their response? Well, in Joshua chapter 1, which I'd like you to come to, Joshua assembled the 2.5 tribes. In fact, it was the first public thing he did on taking over from Moses, the man of God. He brought them all together, the 2.5 tribes, and he said in verse 13, Joshua chapter 1, remember the word. Remember the word. That's an exhortation in itself. Keep in mind the word which has been spoken. Remember the word which Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded you, saying, Yahweh your God hath given you rest and hath given you this land. And so on. Remember your promise. Well, the response was absolutely unhesitating. Verse 16. They answered Joshua, saying, all that thou commandest us, we will do. And whithersoever thou sendest us, we will go. They went further than their original promise. They were prepared to accept additional requirements. All that you've commanded us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we'll go. They hadn't said that to Moses. But there's a readiness and a willingness here to go beyond their original promise. That's the kind of people they are. Verse 17, according as we hearken unto Moses in all things, so we will hearken unto thee. Only Yahweh thy God be with thee, as he was with Moses. Whosoever he be that doth rebel against thy commandments, will not hearken to thy words in all that thou commandest him, he shall be put to death. Only be strong and of a good courage. The word rebel there means to be bitter. These people are saying that if anyone feels bitter about keeping this promise, let him be put to death. You know, that's how they felt. They felt strongly about this. But not only were they prepared to do what Moses and Joshua said, but with a willing heart. And if there were any who were grumbling and complaining and being bitter about this promise, let them be put to death. You know, they were a different people, weren't they, from the generation that perished in the wilderness. Now in Joshua chapter 22, about 7 years later, that's an enormous amount of time to be away from your families. They may have gone back and taken turns, we don't know. But they labored as a group for 7 years to help their brethren receive their inheritance. That's tremendous. Seven, of course, being the number of completion. We say approximately 7 years because the chronology is somewhat uncertain. But that's about the time of the inheritance of most of the tribes. Verse 1 of Joshua 22. Then Joshua called the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, ye have kept all that Moses the servant of Yahweh commanded you, and have obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you. You have not left your brethren these many days unto this day, but you've kept the charge of the commandment of Yahweh your God. And now Yahweh your God hath given rest unto your brethren as he promised them. Therefore now return you and get you to your tents and unto the land of your possession, which Moses the servant of Yahweh gave you on the other side Jordan. You know, it's almost like the words of the Lord himself. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. You know, it's almost that spirit, isn't it? I mean, how would you like to be assembled at the judgment seat and the Lord himself say to you, look, you've kept all that I've asked you to do. You haven't left your brethren. You've kept the charge of the commandments of Yahweh. You've helped your brethren receive their inheritance. Now I'm going to give you yours. You know, we would love to hear those words, wouldn't we? Well, these are the example of people who labored to enter into their rest. And not only so, they labored to help others enter that rest. They are a tremendous example. But Joshua left with them a warning in verse 5. But take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law which Moses the servant of Yahweh charged you, to love Yahweh your God, to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments, to cleave unto him, to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. You know, and that redresses the balance. You've loved your brethren. You've labored for them. But don't neglect to love your God as well. We can be very generous, and we should be. And we can labor for others, and we should. But the heart has to be toward our God as well. We are his workmanship, created in good works. He supplies the strength and the motivation through the word. We can be busy as bees and neglect to love our God with all our heart and our soul and our strength. You see the balance in that? And Joshua appreciated that. And despite all their labors and all their work, their brethren falsely accused them in this chapter. You see, they built an altar on the side of Jordan. Not an altar of sacrifice, but an altar of memorial. And as they built this particular altar on the side of Jordan, the other 10 tribes, whom they labored for so diligently over these years, immediately thought the worst and accused the 2.5 tribes of apostatizing from the faith. How do you think you react to that? After all the work you've done. To have brethren turn around and accuse you of apostatizing. And true to their wonderful spirit, they calmly explained to the other tribes that it was a memorial, not an altar of sacrifice. And the reason why they built it there was because it was their link with the rest of the tribes, that our children may understand that we are together as a nation, worshipping the same God. In 1 Chronicles chapter 5, they returned back to their inheritance. And one would have thought that God would have given them rest. But the battle was not over. There was still work to do. They had their own personal victories to achieve through the power of God. In 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 18, we read of these people. The sons of Reuben and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, of valiant men, men able to bear buckler and sword and to shoot with bow and skillful in war, were 44,703 that went out to war. And you read that verse, and there's a picture of strength, isn't it? I mean, the record is painting that picture as they all march out. Their exact numbers known. They're valiant, able to bear both shield and sword, skillful in using the bow and the arrow, skillful in war. In verse 9, they made war with the Hagarites, with Jeter, with Nephesh and Nodab. And they were helped against them. And the Hagarites were delivered into their hand and all that were with them. For they cried to God in the battle. And he was entreated of them because they put their trust in him. That's why they won. Not because they were skillful, well-armed, valiant, but because they cried to God in the battle and put their trust in him. And the victory that they had achieved for their brethren was now to come home to them in a very personal test. They too were now to be personally tested as they labored to enter into the rest of God. And because of their faith and their trust, their labors were rewarded. But the warning we leave with us all this morning is found for us in verse 25 of this chapter. And they transgressed against the God of their fathers and went a-whoring after the gods of the people of the land whom God destroyed before them. And the people who started so well, who built the sheepfolds for the little ones and the sheep, and had the protections which they so desperately needed in that hostile country, they ended up so badly. The hedges were broken down and they went a-whoring after the things of this world. Brethren, as we come this afternoon to partake of the emblems in remembrance of our Lord, who achieved the victory over his own nature, and through the power of God was able to conquer something which we will never ever be able to achieve. Perfect sinlessness. And we come this afternoon to identify ourselves with that sacrifice. To mortify the deeds of our body and to live unto him. Let's take the exhortations this morning from these glorious people. Who labor to enter into our rest. Labor for our brethren and our sisters until we all together can receive the inheritance of God.